Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Just about everyone is familiar with at least some music by Johann Sebastian Bach. He is one of the towering figures of Western culture, like Shakespeare or Da Vinci. But for a man who casts such a huge shadow, we don't really know a whole lot about him. The renowned conductor Sir John Eliot Gardner has spent decades studying Bach from inside his music and has collected his thoughts into an imposing new book called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. John Eliot Gardner, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
You literally grew up with Bach in the house, right?
Well, it was very odd, yes. A German political refugee pitched up in Dorset, where I was born, with in his rucksack a guitar and the famous Hausmann portrait of Bach. And this was in 1936, before I was born, and he handed it to my father, whom he knew, and said, listen, the war's coming, would you look after it for me? And my dad did, and it was there, it hung on the first floor landing of our house, and I was born in 43, and I remember it for the first 10 years of my life, passed in front of it, and was disconcerted by it, discombobulated by it.
Because this is Bach as the bewigged, kind of severe old man, not a fun-looking guy.
A German politician. And scary. And I was lucky enough as a kid to start to learn some of Bach's music, particularly violin sonatas and concertos and the Brandenburgs and the motets, which I sang as a treble. And I couldn't reconcile the joyousness and the vigor and the liveliness of the music and this forbidding, stern-looking cantor.
So was that kind of the impetus for this book, to try and, you know, find the real Bach behind the music as you knew it?
I guess so, indirectly. I've always, throughout my life, wanted to find a point of conciliation between the almost mathematically precise pedagogical Bach, who wrote, you know, the Well-Tempered Clavier and the Art of Fugue, and who made such an incredible feature out of proportion and order and number. And the other Bach, which is the Bach I knew much better, which is the Bach of the two Passions, the St. Matthew Passion, St. John Passion, the B minor Mass, the Christmas Oratorio, and then this prodigious output of church cantatas, you know, nearly 200 of them.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the cantatas. One of his earliest cantatas, the Actus Tragicus, this is, I mean, people talk about the architecture of Bach, but here you talk about this being an early example of Bach kind of wrestling with his humanity, his mortality, dealing with death, and, you know, dealing with religion, and he sort of idolized Martin Luther. So there's a lot of that going on in this piece, isn't there?
Huge amount of it. And it's sort of symptomatic of a man who's been really buffeted by life already, by losing his parents, both his parents by the time he's 9 and a half, losing brothers, and then going on to lose 10 out of his 23 children.
And one of his two wives.
I mean, somebody who really is on the raw edge of humanity and of existence.
Hmm. This particular passage from the Actus Tragicus does have a kind of comforting sound to it. This is music by Bach, conducted by my guest, the author John Eliot Gardner.
Thank you.
a little bit of the early Bach cantata, number 106, known as the Octus Tragicus. We're speaking with Sir John Eliot Gardner, the renowned conductor, founder of several choirs and orchestras, and conducting, is it the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra in this recording?
Yeah.
The book is called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven, and much of the book looks at Bach's vocal works, the motets, the cantatas especially, the passions, the mass. You have a kind of a special connection to that through growing up with this music.
Yeah, I do, and also I love words, and I'm a wordsmith, and the whole idea of what music and words do to one another interests me. And there's a chapter in my book which I call Collision and Collusion, which is trying to look at the moments when Bach is colliding as opposed to colluding with the words, where he seems to have his own agenda, and he's being a bit subversive about the words that he's setting. And you have to remember, I think, that he's writing at a time when there's a lot of conflict in people's lives. At the beginning of the 18th century, when Germany has just emerged from the 30th War, and is on the brink of enlightenment. I mean, intellectually, the scientific revolution is catching up. And I'm sure in Bach's own school classroom, the whole idea of Galileo and Copernicus and the sun, that didn't penetrate the whole of... it was still a medieval cosmology that he was brought up. But on the other hand, in Leipzig, a university town, that was all going on. He needed to be sufficiently obedient to the clergy to justify his position as cantor. But at the same time, he was right up against them because they didn't understand his music making.
Well, that is one of the other themes that continues throughout the book is how much many of his contemporaries just didn't get it.
They didn't get it at all. And it's also symptomatic of the fact that Bach didn't write an opera, and they all did. Mm. Opera was perceived as the sexy outlet. The best career move was to become an opera composer. You earn more money that way. Bach didn't do it. Now, why? Was it an allergic reaction to opera, or did he think it trivial, or what was going on there? And it's difficult to say, but I have a feeling that it's a mixture of things. I think he objected to the two-paced nature of opera, that on the one hand, all the action takes place in recitative, which is pataphysm, and you get through it as fast as possible, and that tells you who's fighting who, who's going to bed with who. Then you have the arias, which is the moment of reflection and emotion, which describes the dilemma and the rhetoric and the emotional state of an individual character. And he thought, this is ridiculous. I'm putting words into his mouth, but I suspect he found that preposterous. So what does he do? He uses the cloak and costumes, as it were, metaphorically speaking, of opera, and puts it into church music.
So the passions have a kind of operatic quality. I mean, it's...
a dramatic quality. Yeah, I don't think they're ersatz operas. So they're not proto-operas, but they are incredibly dramatic. And it's almost as if they're mutant operas. the gene has shifted. It's jumped tracks. And it's manifested itself in an opera of the imagination rather than of the stage.
And, you know, when we talk about the Bach passions, most people talk about the St. Matthew Passion. You have a lot to say about the St. John Passion, often seen as the earlier sort of half-formed sibling to the later one.
I'm not saying it's the greater work, but I think it's the more radical of the two. It's the one that where he sets out his stall and he really delivers with it such a big punch. It's so intense, and it's all to do with John's gospel account as opposed to Matthew's account. I mean, John is an eyewitness account of the Passion story, and Bach makes us experience the Passion story through John's eyes, and that gives it a fantastic authority and currency, but also just the sheer density of the musical argument and the way that in the courtroom, I mean, the two courtroom trials, there's the Sanhedrin trial when Jesus is up in front of the high priest, and then there's one with Pontius Pilate. And he crafts them so cleverly. I mean, you sense in the Sanhedrin trial that everything is stacked up against him, that it's a kangaroo court, really. There's no chance. When he's with Pontius Pilate, it's man to man. The crowd is kept outside the doors. They bay, they shout, they hammer on the door, and Pilate is clearly scared of them. And he's trying to establish a direct one-to-one relationship with Jesus. Doesn't really work because Jesus gives him very monosyllabic answers. But Bach sets these two trials so brilliantly, and you feel that there is a stage set, two different stage sets, and the camera is, as it were, going from one to the other. I mean, to have that graphic imagination, to be able to focus that into music, that's brilliant.
We're speaking with Sir John Eliot Gardner. His new book is called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. And at one point, writing about the St. John Passion, you mentioned when the opening chorus comes in, and I'm going to quote you here, something of unprecedented, shocking power occurs. From the Bach St. John Passion, a little bit of the opening chorus, conducted by John Eliot Gardner and featuring the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra. That moment discussed in the new book, Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. The Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra, one of several groups that you've founded and led over the years. You've been a pivotal figure in the so-called performance, you know, early music performance practice movement. Did that come from growing up and hearing performances of Bach that had this kind of grim, plodding sound to them?
Yeah, it did. I think that was a negative premise anyway, that I couldn't reconcile, just as I couldn't reconcile the portrait of this grim-looking man and the dance music that I cherished. When I heard performances of his motets and his passions, they were either on such a huge scale with enormous chorus performed on Good Friday in a kind of Victorian sanctimonious ritual, or they were Karl Richter in Germany with a very, very aggressive approach to the music. And I heard Benjamin Britten conducting St. John Passion. That was a lot better, but it was in English, and I felt that the German language is critical to an understanding of Bach. So I had to find my own way through, really, and there were no models at the time. And there's been a lot of controversy since. You know, was Bach writing for a tiny choir, a tiny ensemble of just four singers, or eight singers at the most, and single part? Was that forced on him, or was it that his ideal, or was it a pragmatic solution that he hit upon? I mean, it's a big, long, quite acrimonious debate that's been going on both sides of the Atlantic for the last 25 years, 30 years. And so there's all that to deal with, and you inch your way through towards what you think is the right solution, and then you find that there's other considerations and you want to take them on board. I find it's a perpetual voyage of discovery, and Bach is endlessly fascinating and endlessly challenging to the musician, endlessly challenging to you as a conductor.
And to you as a biographer as well, because...
Oh, enormously, because you've got so little to go on. I mean, you've got practically no family letters, no descriptions. Can you imagine? I mean, you know, all these cantatas and the passions, and there's not one clear description of how the audience, how the congregation responded to this music. I mean, did they shrug it off? Did they say it's too complex? Did they get bored? Did they go to sleep? Did they worship him? You know, what went on?
Yeah, although you do infer from things that other people wrote that, you know, as we said before, people didn't always get it.
No.
Although a select few, enough did to keep him...
Yes, I think
feeding the kids, the many kids.
Yes, I think it was a very hard furrow for him to plow.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, he took on the job as cantor in Leipzig in the most unpropitious circumstances. And he was right up against the town council and the clergy right from the word go. And they lied to him. They didn't tell him the full truth of what his contract meant. So that wasn't easy for him. Yeah. And there is a floor line right down his character between a very collegial, very good father figure, very collegial to his his peers and other musicians, and a cantankerous, abrasive, angry man who didn't suffer fools gladly and who couldn't understand the pig-headed nature of the opposition that he got from the town council. And he managed, nonetheless, through just dint of sheer singleness of purpose and ambition and energy, to ride the storm and to produce a phenomenal amount of music.
Mm-hmm. What was that singleness of purpose?
I think it was partly innate or inherent, and it's part of his DNA, that he felt, as a Bach, a part of the biggest, you know, collection family of musicians in Germany in the end of the 17th, early 18th century, that he had a God-given obligation to fulfill a role as the servant of the Lord. It's a very Old Testament kind of thing.
Yeah.
And in the very first hymn book that he sang from, you see a picture of David, King David, and or King Solomon at the temple, surrounded by his musicians, and underneath it there's a picture of Eisenach. So the connection was made visually, graphically to him, between him as a servant, as a musician serving the Lord, and being the Bach that was the one who was going to deliver the goods.
Right, because the Bach family was making music in Germany, as they say, from the time of
Luther
to the time of Bismarck.
Yeah, that's so correct.
Over like three centuries of music being passed from one generation to the other. Now, all of this sounds very kind of self-righteous, and again, you know, the bewigged, severe, glum old man that you passed every day on the first floor landing of your house. But, you know, give him trumpets and drums, and something happens.
It certainly does.
Listen to this moment from the famous Bach Mass in B minor. Some of the Gloria from the Mass in B minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. My guest, John Elliott Gardner, conducting the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra. And he is author of the new book, Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. The subtitle is not a random thing. I mean, you talked before about, you know, this was church music, much of it.
Yeah, but it's not churchy music.
No. No,
I mean,
it's not.
Just that Gloria that you it's not a, it's not like in Messiah where you have the angels singing and Handel brings in the angel like a squadron of aircraft and they bring the good news to earth and then they fly off again. Bach is doing a peasant dance on earth. Mm-hmm. It's like a painting by Bruegel. It's not a wafty esoteric thing. That's what I love about him so much.
So that kind of earthy, you know, the guy who knew all the dances, the guy who got in trouble as a teenager, lots of trouble apparently, you know, who you refer to at one point as like a reformed thug.
A proto-hooligan.
Yeah, proto-hooligan.
Yeah.
This was Bach too.
Exactly. Both sides of it. And that's what makes him so approachable.
So it's music in the castle of heaven, and yet it is very earthy music as well. Is that why people who are not Lutheran, who are not religious, will still respond to these masses and cantatas and passions?
Absolutely. You have to get through the membrane of the theology, and then you're into the uplands of extraordinary humanity, and that's what makes it so attractive.
The book is called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven, by the conductor and now author John Elliott Gardner. And Sir John, this has been great fun having you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.